Welcome to the Spirit Aligned Legacy Leadership Program, Legacy Leader Podcast. Today we are speaking with Circle One Legacy Leader Yvonne Peterson from the Chehalis Reservation in Washington from a September 2020 interview with Gail Small.
Pivot Ishiv, good day. My name is Gail Small, and I'm the program director for the Spirit Aligned Leadership Program. Very honored today to be interviewing and visiting with my sister, Yvonne Peterson. And I ask Yvonne if you would please introduce yourself.
Hoi, I'm Yvonne Peterson. I'm Chehalis, Nisqually, Potawatomi, Sac and Fox. I carry the Chehalis name, Tuni Mo. And literally translated in our language, my name means my village is sending a person. And I received this as an adult, so this is an adult name. And I had already just received my certification as a public school teacher, and I was going to the Skokomish village to work with their people. So they selected a name that would represent my life's work. So the village of Chehalis at Oakville, Washington, Upper Chehalis, we as a people are sending Tuni Moose to work with education issues. On my mother's side, Chehalis Nisqually, and on my father's side, Joseph James Dupuy, I am Potawatomi and Sac and Fox. And my older brothers were the ones that were embraced by the Potawatomi people and carry names from the Potawatomi. We're Prairie Band Potawatomi from Horton, Kansas. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I traveled to that area to visit my people. I am one of 14, and two in my family were adopted out, but we always knew where my brother was. He was adopted by my mom's parents, and my sister was returned to us October 31st, 1991. And currently, I have five sisters still living and two brothers still living. I was raised as the oldest daughter of a family of eight by my mom, who was a single parent. So that's who I am, and as the interview continues, I will give more information.
Thank you, Yvonne. You know, I always think that identity is so important to us, you know, to everyone, but in particular to us as Native women. So like your story of how you got your name, you know, and then just the family background, you know, like for me, like, for example, like what you say, I also have an adult name that I got after winning actually a big lawsuit. It was a getting the first high school on our reservation. I was given a new name, an adult name to carry on. And it's a real beautiful name. It's a head chief woman, Vihona, in my language. But then we also had like a childhood name, right?
Right.
And so we kind of, it's always interesting that our culture, our way of thinking, it includes like the journey of life. Like, you know, we were born. So my mother's best friend gave me her name. Beautiful name too. You know, Nisa Ayo.
Right.
And then as my life went on, I went to college like you, law school, and then took on this big issue that the young people at my tribe wanted to high school. You know, we're tired of being sent to the border towns, you know, being called prairie niggers, just treated so racially discriminatory. So then we brought this case. It was a case that had been going on in my tribe for 35 years, and we finally won. And at that point, it was a huge celebration in the community, and unexpectedly, I was honored with this new name. And so that's my adult name. So I share with you, you know, the importance of knowing who we are.
Right.
So with what you said, Yvonne, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, that era that you grew up in. You know how, like, I know I've heard you tell me the story of this fabulous Hazel Pete. And then how did it happen when she had these, you know, so many children? How did people end up being adopted? It was a time period, you know, a huge disruption of our culture during the time that she was living and giving birth. And I always think that, you know, let's talk a little bit about that so our listener understands the, you know, our own lives, how we end up where we are today.
Right. Well, both of my parents were boarding school survivors, and both had radically different experiences. Hazel Pete credits the boarding school for the opportunity to live. Had she stayed on the Chehalis Reservation, tuberculosis was taking a great toll on the health of the people, but on the lives of the people. So she and a brother were sent away to boarding school, and a younger sister stayed home. And so she had a relatively good experience. Friends all across the country, as she attended boarding school at Chemawa, and then also attended boarding school at Tulalip. And later, as a weaving family, as we would be called in and with families, but onto reservations to work with people on basketry. When we were at Tulalip one summer, we took a walk for a break with one of the young women. And we were on the bluff where the old Tulalip school is, and we were looking down. And she said, this brings back so many memories, because we were soon to have one of the canoe journeys to Tulalip. But she said when she was a student there, the macaw canoes came into that area. And see, you travel on canoes according to the tide. So they were arriving with the tide, but it was soon to leave. So the people from the school went down to gather these children, but they didn't want to leave. They didn't want to leave their families, and the canoes had to leave. They literally rested a stop, and then they were on their way because the tide was going out. And she said, when you hear the seagulls, and the sky was full of seagulls, she said, that's what it sounded like when these little kids were crying down below. And she walked down, because she was one of the class representatives. She was a sergeant, and she was one of the people that marched the groups around, because it was Army style, Army protocol. But she was one of the people that went down and hugged a third grader, and they became lifelong friends while they were at boarding school, and then remained in touch. So we always had a place to stay when we traveled to the Macaw Reservation. So it makes me imagine that the boarding schools and the taking of our children, that fifth step of colonization, after they take the land, they take the resources, they take the legitimacy of thought, they take our traditional governance, and then they take the children. So see, they were trying to separate tribal people from their Indian ways. But in many individuals, they held whatever they had as they left their people, their grandparents, their aunts and uncles, and their parents. Whatever they had, they kept and held it tight. So I always think of that day with Mom and these young macaw kids who were coming up to that boarding school for the first time. That was representative of her life, was to always embrace. And that's what she modeled for us. And I always think that as young people, we have watched our parents. I always thought that my dad represented the way he lived his life. I always thought to myself, I will never do that. 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 And He was very tall as a Potawatomi, 6'5", very good looking. Mom always said, because she was 4'10", I'm going to marry a man who is tall, strong, and has perfect teeth, because those were the things she felt like she didn't have. And so when Joe Dupuy came to our reservation, here was this 6'6" man working with our people who, at that generation, many were not taller than 5'2". Mm-hmm. And he would have a hoe, and he would have to bend down, you know, to be out in the crops, working the crops with everyone else. But later, as I came to know my dad's upbringing and life, of which he didn't talk about, mm-hmm. I recognized the trauma that he survived while in boarding school, he and his sister. Mm-hmm. And both of my parents lived into their 80s. My Aunt Gertrude, so that would be Joe Dupuy's full sister, lived to be in her 90s. So a wealth of information came forward towards the end of his life and then after his life. So I had a better understanding. But one time I was reflecting about my life, in my 40s or 50s, and I thought to myself, all of those things that I always thought about my dad were the things that I actually embodied, and they are what also made me strong. Mm-hmm. So the things that you get from your full-time caregiver, the one who raises you, and Hazel Pete was certainly that as a single parent. And then the things that I did not value from my dad were also the things that embodied my total personality. One of the things was he could command an audience. Mm-hmm. He was a gifted orator. Mm-hmm. He could tell stories. He could help heal. He could give his opinions. He could move a community to activism. He often was the person who was the camp organizer, like at the Pendleton Roundup. Mm-hmm. For years, he would arrive 2 weeks early and begin to put the people and the teepees and the dancers and all of the different people who have these different responsibilities at a thing like the Pendleton Roundup, a rodeo and powwow, and Slahal. So he was that type of organizer. But it took him away from home so much mm-hmm. that I didn't like that. And yet I can be in front of a crowd and mm-hmm. be at a microphone and have no fear. And I know that's his ability that has, that I was watchful of mm-hmm. and that embraced and then has become a part of my life. But during my lifetime, so see, I'm now talking about Hazel Pete. On the Chehalis Indian Reservation, we did not have a paved road, running water, or electricity. Mm-hmm. She had 8 children to raise.
Wow.
How do you do that from sunrise? How do you get the fire going? How do you get water boiled? How do you get the food cooked? And so, see, while my dad was still living with us, myself and my younger sister, we were the ones that were up at 4:30 helping him get that big pot belly fire going. And then he left for whatever job he was doing. Usually it was logging camp, mm-hmm. which is why we were up so early, because we got the fire going and then he left. And my younger sister and I still have that routine. Mm-hmm. We can call each other at 5:00 in the morning, knowing that we're already up. Mm-hmm. But all my brothers are cooks. All my brothers know how to raise young children, because when my mom left for the field as a migrant worker, and she usually maintained three jobs.
Three jobs.
My brothers were the ones that helped raise us. And when my daughters were starting to date and look for a future partner, that's what I would always say. Well, always look for an Indian man who is the oldest of at least five children, because he'll be able to cook, clean, and raise kids.
Isn't that true? You know, but imagine like your mother had three jobs with eight children.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. And she was a certified instructor from the first graduating class of the Institute of American Indian Arts. Oh. For years, it was a K-12 mm-hmm. high school. Well, when they made it into the Institute of American Indian Arts, she was in the first class. So she left from boarding school, did her own application, and was on a bus for 3 days to get down there, and then stayed with that graduating class, and then worked at Laguna Pueblo, for instance, Riverside, California, Warm Springs, Oregon. And then as the war hit, people were called, so for our tribe, to Seattle to work on, but they always say the munitions, they would pack the munitions and get them on the ships. Mm-hmm. So that's what our people did. And many cousins, so female cousins or sisters, would get a single apartment. And then they would work in the shipyards. So that's what my mom did. And that's how she met my dad, because he was also working there. So one other thing about the Chehalis Indian Reservation, there were very few Indian people who were living on that reservation compared to today, where mm-hmm. of the 800, 600 live the Chehalis Reservation. Mm-hmm. But at that point, there were probably seven major families. And so we as children would walk across those prairies, get to the rivers, both the Chehalis and the Black River. So my generation of young people, there would be kids 5 years older than the age group, and then kids 5 to 8 years younger. So we would be this group of tribal kids walking, picking wild strawberries together, picking June berries together. The trees were very small seedlings, but at least 30 feet tall. And that was a real test of courage and skill to be on the tops of those fir trees and then make it swing to the next one. You'd grab on, make it swing to the next one. So, swimming down at one of the areas where we'd all walk down and picnic together. And, you know, I always think about when I tell my own children about being 6, 7, and 8. So my brother would have been 8, I was 7, and then a sister was 6. We were in charge of a younger sister and the twins and then a baby. And wow. We had a little red wagon, and my mom would help us pack that. And we would walk about a mile and a half to go swimming. And I talk about this in one of my articles about the mint tea aroma that was heavy as we walked that trail, but also the lush undergrowth. But see, we would have been little kids. Mm-hmm. I would never have allowed my kids to do that.
Yeah.
But the days, the time was different.
Yes.
I would say safer.
Yes.
Of course, it had its own challenges, because we would have been swimming when we were down at the river. We would have been playing like kids mm-hmm. do, and mm-hmm. someone could have gotten lost. We never did. Uh-huh. But so those are the kinds of childhood moments that I remember. Mm-hmm. There was one horrific day when my mom was at work as a field boss, it was during strawberry season, and my sister fell, a plate broke, and it severed below her knee, right above her all of the tendons and small bones, and her foot collapsed.
Oh.
And I had to stay with her, so we sent my sister to the neighbor about probably a half a mile, quarter of a mile away. But she was not a talker. She had the power of speech, but there were so many of us, she always said, I didn't need to talk. So she had to go to see our neighbor to tell her, my sister is hurt. Bring your car. Well, she did drive down, but she could tell she couldn't do anything without mom. So then she drove to where mom was working, and then mom came home. And we didn't have a car. Mom would walk there to work and then walk back home. So others came and got Trudy, and she was gone for a year. One of the first surgeries where all of those tendons were tied back together again, the bones reset. And then, of course, she had physical therapy. So when she returned home after a year, my dad said, there's a sack of potatoes in the car. Would you kids go out and get it? So we went out, and there was this girl sitting in the car. And my brother, what a kidder. But I actually think there was parts of this that he thought was true. He opened up his eighth grade Spanish book and said, I know who this is. She's right here. She's Mexican, and she's coming to stay with. So we're all standing around listening, looking at her. And she said, he said, we've now adopted her. So you know how kids are when the parents aren't around? We were always telling my younger sister that she was adopted. That she was Mexican, but now she would be Indian. Later in life, as we're sitting around the table telling stories like this, mm-hmm. my mom was just outraged that we did this to our younger sister. And so, you know, for her, I think it bordered on that shock and trauma of being so severely injured mm-hmm. and then having to be away at a hospital that length of time. Mm-hmm. She knew of us, but of course, 1 year away, what it must do to the mind. Mm-hmm. So, I think in a family of eight, you have an identity and the perspective, but all of us are going through trying times mm-hmm. at a different age. Mm-hmm. Most of us are only 18 months apart, but some of us are 6 years apart and 8 years apart. And so I know some of the things that I went through with my dad. Well, he was a drinker and a carouser, and there was no stopping domestic violence. Mm-hmm. I think that those kinds of memories are within my waking memory. But for the kids who either slept through it or were somehow protected from it because we either kept the door shut or kept our voices low or never talked about it with them, they have a different perspective of what life was like on the reservation. Mm-hmm. 1 year, years later, during one of my summer breaks, I did an education survey among our people for how we were going to establish education for the tribe for the future. And I discovered just within my own family how different our ideas were about what we even went through within the public school. Our reservation is divided by a county line.
Yes.
So the few of us, so the few kids at that time they were on the Grace Harbor side, so they went to another district. Mm-hmm. And then my whole family, eight of us, were in another school district. Mm-hmm. And, so we were the only Indians there.
Wow.
And I always think about, with such a large family, my older brothers could have, should have told me what I was going to go through. But even after I went through it, I never told my sister, and I never told my younger sister, what was even going to happen on the first day of school when you're in school with Norwegian children, immigrants, the mm-hmm. immigrant children of their immigrant parents. So I always think about how did that become a rule, mm-hmm. a protocol, that even within a family, you don't talk about these harsh things.
Reflections of Hazel Peet, Education and Identity.
I think for Hazel Peet, once, and so this would have been closer to the 60s, I would have been close to graduating and was working as a waitress at a truck stop. And my younger sisters would travel with my mom. Because of her degree, she started working night school at the community colleges in the area. Mm-hmm. So she was an educated woman, although she was doing migrant work. Mm-hmm. And so I always think about that, mm-hmm. what Indian women as young mothers mm-hmm. will do, must do, should do, so that their children survive in a strong, healthy way. So I think the 40s, so my mom would have been born in 1915. And so by the time she was raising us, her three older generations had passed. Her own mother and father were going to pass. So I think there was a significant loss mm-hmm. in terms of the support that we now have. I mean, if my daughters, when I was raising them, if I needed a sitter, I could call ahead and let a brother or a sister know, I'm going to be dropping off Billy in 2 hours. Make sure someone's there to open up the door. Mm-hmm. So, and that had happened constantly when I was raising my kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you think about that era of like Hazel Peet, you know, your mother raising all these children, getting an education, having to work three jobs, including being a migrant worker, and then never having the, today you look at like the movement that's occurring across the country to look at white privilege. You know, the Norwegian immigrants who had came into your land, right, and didn't acknowledge that. In fact, treated you, and like you say, it almost kind of became oppressive where you couldn't even share with your own siblings that you're going to go to school with these white immigrants and beware of how they're going to treat you, so, you know, racially discriminatory. So I always think about that, those generations, and how we're still wrestling with that now, from your mother being born in 1915 to where we are now, 2020.
Right.
And you think much has changed, Yvonne?
Well, because my dad is Potawatomi Sac and Fox, we did not have the nutrition, so we did not grow to be 6 feet tall. My brothers are not 6 feet tall, but we have the gene for the next generation and the next generation to have this stature. But we are bigger than some of the Chehalis. So speaking of my generation. So, you know, I'm not sure what it is within an individual, but we did not have kindergarten. We had first grade, and the first grade day that I got on the bus and then went to Mrs. Ruge, and Mrs. Ruge had all of my older brothers. So she modeled for my Norwegian counterparts. And most of them were Swedish. So see, they're platinum blonde and white skin so thin that you can see their blood veins. So this is my first experience where 30 of my classmates, I'm thinking, oh my God, their blood is going to just burst at any. But of course, I've been trained to be stoic. So mm-hmm. I'm not exclaiming, even with facial features, that, oh my God, look at this. But as Mrs. Ruge went around, and we had blue boy pencils, they're quite thick, probably as thick as your little finger. And so she went around and touched each individual, each kid, to show them how to hold it while they would write. Mm-hmm. But when she got to me, she didn't touch me. Mm-hmm. So see, that's a signal to the other kids that there's something significantly different about Yvonne Dupuy. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be hands off, and I won't be giving her an edge in anything. What teachers failed to recognize is that Hazel Pete's children knew how to read, write, and do some mathematics because she was a teacher. Mm-hmm. When we played at home, we played school, mm-hmm. because Hazel Pete was always about reading, writing, and knowing facts. On the radio, once we got a landline phone, she would always call in. So the radio would have a contest and she'd know the answer. So she'd either have one of us call or she'd call. So it's that kind of modeling that you know. Mm-hmm. So even that first day of class, I proclaimed to myself in my head, so this is how it's going to be. Mm-hmm. I will need to, every gain that I make in this classroom will be because I'm forceful about it. And back then, there was the bluebirds and the, you know, all of the reading groups and math groups were according to birds. So then I could figure out which one was the top reading group. Mm-hmm. So that was my goal. The top math group, that was my goal, was to be in these different groups. And but see, to do that at 6 years of age,
yes,
it starts to set in motion a momentum where it's about survival and gain and being acclaimed somehow. But it never came from the Indian community. Of course, my mom was ultimately proud of academic accomplishments. But so this cultural awareness of being competitive within white academics and being competitive culturally within the tribal community, it's not like those two things are congruent. It's not like they come together and mean the same thing. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, my parents spoke the language. Mm-hmm. And I mean my grandparents, mm-hmm. Frank Pete and Hazel Pete. Mm-hmm. And Hazel Pete knew the Chehalis, the Nisqually language as well, because she was full Nisqually and then adopted into Chehalis. So when I say I'm Chehalis Nisqually, it's equal. Mm-hmm. And but they had already made the decision that for the next generation, what a load it is.
Yes.
To put on an Indian kid's shoulders in terms of what you will have to do in order to survive if you also speak your language. It's not like anybody said this out loud. That generation just made that decision. And what's remarkable is, because Hazel Pete at night would take us to the tribal meetings, mm-hmm. we heard our language spoken. Mm-hmm. And so then Hazel, because she had been gone to boarding school and then IAIA and then taught and then worked in the worked in Seattle during the war and then came home, so much time had passed. There was also this acclimation that a person has to do to find your way back into the tribe.
Yes.
And so she was always alert to be grasping on to the words so that there would be something to pass to her children, the next generations, which would be us. Going back to that first day of class for me, it doesn't really become an outward awareness for me that I was so driven, so competitive to be the top student that you lose this ability to be close friends with anyone. But also, these were very strange white kids. Mm-hmm. I could not see that we had anything in common. Mm-hmm. Although there was a conversation in high school with several of my, so I'm going to use the word friends. Mm-hmm. But they would be more acquaintances because we all knew each other. We had been in the same classes from first grade. But one of the students talked about how she was amazed that I could talk about my parents being divorced, mm-hmm. separated, and my mom raising us. And then another person offered that it was also hard for her. And so out of the seven young women sitting there, five were in now homes where the father had left. And so see, in my head, I'm now becoming that, oh my God, they have probably some like challenges that I have. Mm-hmm. And but it still wasn't this piece where I was quote unquote these bosom buddies,
yeah, you know,
friends with non-Indians. So that's always been amazing to me when I may or may not have someone who, quote unquote, is a friend, mm-hmm. but I know friendship among my sisters. Yes. And now because I've been married for 52 years, I know what it is to have a friend, have significant friendship with my husband, because someone asked me as it was getting close to 50 years of marriage, what I had learned, what could I pass on? And I said, you know, if you commit to it and stay with your life's mate to the end. And I said, and I know we're not at the end, but now we're friends as opposed to at the beginning where it's, altruistic and it's love. Everybody's envious that you have the most ideal mate and he's working. And then when he got a college education, whoa. So I think that and we were so committed to our own work that if any of us had the day off, either I was with our daughter or Gary was with our daughter. So we never saw each other in action until we both ended up teaching here at Evergreen. Mm-hmm. And then we got on the same team. So I know he could value my role in what I do as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And then I could value what he would bring to the team as a teacher. And so, see, again, it's almost like it repeats itself that as young brothers and sisters, we never took the time to really talk mm-hmm. and say, this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I'm sure even when our brothers left for the military, the older brother never told the next brother, this is what you're up against. This is what it's going to be like. Yeah. All served in the military, except the youngest one, because the others had already served. And in reflection, if I were to say to a young person, in terms of one of the things I regret mm-hmm. is not having taken that time to make opportunity to have enduring conversations with a brother, a sister, a cousin. And so then move it out from there. Mm-hmm. Another young person who is going to go the same route I did, which ended up being higher education. And as a teacher, working with young women who gravitate to Gary and I because we teach, and I mean young Indigenous students, mm-hmm. and they could be Indian, Pacific Islander, Mexican, Asian, Vietnamese, so they gravitate to us, and sometimes I will make a point to say, and I accent it, I'll turn the lights off, mm-hmm. and I'll say, I need the women to hear this. Mm-hmm. And I'm only going to say it once. And see, you can hear a pin drop. And then I'll leave this gem with them in terms of hold tight to, so if I were to say identity, and all of us really are unique. Mm-hmm. So see, I don't have to tell you that. You already know it. Mm-hmm. But hold tight to identity, but not so tight that you can't leave an opportunity to have a conversation with somebody else.
Yes.
To say, mm-hmm. either, is this happening to you? Or you could say, this is happening to me. How does this sound to you? Mm-hmm. So that you have this common thread that continues to be a basis for friendship.
Returning home.
You know, given your mother's life, your own personal life, you know that there's a lot of young women with single mothers really struggling across, really the globe. And, the advice that you give is like knowing your identity is going to strengthen you. But also, like, I see, like, a lot of young women and young men who put so much effort maybe into education or college or say they're adopted out and they want to go home. But they always want to go back to our homelands, to the reservations or to, wherever it is. And, like, you talk about your mother's story of having been gone to school and work, and she came home, would go to tribal meetings, and was trying to get reintegrated. Is there any advice, that you could give, like, young people who are on that journey?
You have to give it time. So if you're imagining, okay, I found who my people are, and see Gary as a social worker. So he's hired here at the college as a social worker. And so he's helped Indian young men and women get their records open so that they, and so he has a network of people who can help them get connected to their, sometimes they don't want to quote unquote get to know their family. They want to simply be enrolled and give notice to their family that contact me if you wish. But my experience for the sister who was returned to us as a very adult woman, and then two nephews who have been returned to our family. We literally formed an extended family circle so that they could come into the circle and look at the faces and generations that surround them in terms of they belong. They belong initially within the family. And Gary's point is that it's bumpy. There are pitfalls. Because we're unique and we have personalities. And so it reminds me of my five sisters that we always tease one of them about being the fun police. If it looks like teenagers have too much fun, she's right there breaking it up. Or if the little kids aren't sold. And I have one sister who has that kind of Indian woman voice that you can hear across a football field. So if somebody needs correction, you know, at the next house, she's got them on her radar through her voice. And then all of us, I know through our eyebrows and the ability not to blink. So once you have a kid's attention, you're that kid, they know, is on call. Because I'm not blinking until you nod to me that you know what I'm talking about. But see, I'm not talking. I'm just looking. So we're arrogant individuals that we're assuming that if I'm returning home to my reservation after having been gone for 4 years of higher education, work experience, maybe the service, maybe getting married, and bringing my partner home who's not even from there. See, we're arrogant enough to think that we get on the reservation and I'm here. And see that people are liable to say, so what? That's what I mean about time. Mm-hmm. You need to go to every invitation, the health fair, the tribal celebrations, the ceremonies, if there's a call for help, we need help to get the graveyards ready for Memorial Day. Well, you're the first one there with all your equipment. So see, it's things like that that build the foundation rather than the announcement, I'm here now, mm-hmm. I'm back. So I think, the arrogance and the self-centeredness and the egocentricity are things that have managed to keep us strong in the outside. But when we're with our people, we have to let that go now because, see that word people. Now it's 800 strong, mm-hmm. all their spouses. Mm-hmm. So see, we're coming in. See, we need to be as embraceful of all the other as opposed to thinking, oh, be so glad I'm here.
Yes, I hear you. You know, I think about that, like when I got home from law school, right? I went to law school at the University of Oregon. It was a real arduous effort for me because I didn't think like that. And I got home and I always remember one of my grandmothers was talking to me and she said, I want you to slow down and not try to be doing so much all the time. You're home now. And it just resonated with me that I had become like that in law school because I was juggling so much, right?
Right.
And mm-hmm. I was really the only Indian in my entire law school class. And right. Just struggling with that whole idea that they were teaching me that, you know, we were discovered, the doctrine of discovery, right? And I was like, how can I learn this? This is not truth.
Right.
So I was like, well, I have to just learn it and pass the exams and not challenge my professors and them and not stand out. Just try to, you know, get through it. But it affects your heart, it affects your thinking, And then when you get home, it's like a big adjustment again. So like during my personal experience, what helped me so much was just my parents were still alive, you know, all my sisters and brothers, which was wonderful. I could go right back into the home. But what really helped me was being on the land, because I grew up on the land.
Yes.
I would literally just go up on certain areas of our homeland and lay down.
Yes.
And say, I just need to get strong. I need to get strong here again. Because what I've been through out there in law school was almost like a war.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
So I think about that, you know, for young people, you know, what we need to share, like you say, let's share with them that it's not all about you when you come home. There is responsibilities and obligations that you have to take on, you know, and I always see that even like with my own kids that come home from college, they come back to the reservation. They're very, it's a hard adjustment for them. And like, I remember one of my children told me one time, Mom, why are you always going to funerals? I said, because, you know, we're part of a tribe. We know everybody. They're related to us somehow. And I'm taking food. I'm taking blankets. I'm taking material because we're helping out. That's what you do when you're part of a tribe. You give of yourself whatever you have. Maybe, you know, I'm very famous for my potato salad. When a funeral comes up and, you know, I walk in, they always say, oh my God, Gail's bringing her potato salad, you know. But I just share that with, you know, the listener too, that, you know, it's not about you being, you know, like you said so well, Yvonne, hey, I'm home. It's not that. It's like reintegrate yourself into a tribe.
Right.
Be responsible for helping the tribe to the best of your ability. And don't ever think, well, what am I getting out of it?
Right. Mm-hmm. I think that's initially one of the things that Hazel Pete taught. See, if you're on the reservation, and we were just like all of the other families on the reservation, we had nothing. But you know, when our grandparents were returning from boarding schools, they were coming with some skill sets that would set in motion, ready for paved roads, running water, and electricity. The homes that the men built were ready for toilets, mm-hmm. and running water and bathtubs. The outlets were there for the electricity that they knew were coming, but they just did not come for 20 years. So this idea of group work to better all the people on the reservation, there was never this, we're not going to go work on that house. They're not our relatives.
Yeah.
Not going to go work on that house. It's too far away.
Mm-hmm.
But the opposite happened. They all came because they knew they could either hammer, they could read the plans, mm-hmm. they could sketch the plans, they knew how to order the wood. Mm-hmm. Some would saw their own wood. Mm-hmm. See, those were the skill sets that came home from the boarding school with our grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the other thing about our grandparents, because they spoke our language, they knew that they could be watchful of a career that they knew would be needed back on the reservation. Frank Pete, so that would have been Hazel Pete's dad, my grandfather, was the first police, but he also became a federal officer and judge on the reservation. And so he would travel to Tacoma and sit in the federal, the courthouse, and watch the protocol. So he would spend his off time, because he worked at Cushman in maintenance. And so his off time, off days, he would go to the courthouse. And so he knew the protocol of how you give advance notice, how you do this, how you keep a record. So then as he became deputized and was serving on the Chehalis Reservation, he became this respected individual that you would go to. So, but see, there would be other like careers that tribal people invested in. They couldn't go to vocational school or college, but they could be watchful for how these jobs got accomplished. And then that's what they would bring back to the reservation. Mm-hmm. And I always think about some of our young people, but see, this would be in my grandparents' age, but also my mom's generation. Horse racing, if you can believe this, Gail, on the Chehalis Reservation was a real big thing. So tribal men, well, their families, would travel to what's now called Emerald Downs and be watching. So this is the protocol. This is how they and they would be back watching how the training was being done. The different fence yards that needed to be built. And so then those were being repeated on the Chehalis Reservation. We were, like many tribes, but you had to have a prairie, did overland canoe races. Mm-hmm. And so those were on foot. And they would go the whole prairie, 5 miles back. And we would still recreate that at our annual Indian days on the Chehalis Reservation, the last weekend in May. But the horse races would also take place on the prairie. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just typical Indians. I have a blanket. This is what I'm bedding. I have cigarettes. This is what I'm bedding. But some people might actually have money. Mm-hmm. But when they were professionally racing in at Emerald Downs, but as I recall, it had a different name then. Mm-hmm. So the tribal people would take their horse up there and then race it. And so see, that's what I mean about this capacity to imagine your role within the tribe and then be watchful for identifying the skill sets for what you need to learn, do, build, create, network. What are the other kinds of things that I will need if I'm raising horses? So where do I get the hay? Who helps me with the fences? All of those kinds of things. And so then it would be recreated back on this reservation.
Reclaiming during the pandemic.
Thing, Yvonne, like with the pandemic that's occurring right now where everything's kind of shifting, right? And you, like what you're talking about is really life skills, like relevant life skills.
Yes.
You know, particularly geared to where you're going to live. Do you see that emerging, or, you know, I guess re-emerging?
And so I would use the word reclaiming. Mm-hmm. So I have to admit, when we were released from school in March and told to stay home, we were to be sheltered at home and everything was going to go virtual. It was right at our break. And I went into a low-grade depression. And see, I say low-grade depression because I know that people who really suffer from lifelong depression, it affects everything about them. Probably even the chemicals within their body. But my depression was, see, I'm this person that gets up at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. Well, I don't need to do that now if you're sheltered at home, because nobody is waking up till 8, 9. So with my sisters, I was reaching out to say, man, I I cannot cope. So then we got into this making baskets, using our supplies from the previous seasons, and taking up beading, pulling out some of Mom's collection and challenging each other. How did she start this? What was her thinking that went into it? And so now that we're very experienced, and I'm just talking about my family, my grandson will be coming out as a weaver. He was supposed to do that in February, just as we were in May, just as we were sheltered at home. Well, so now it's branched out that his giveaway items, he's making for the 25-year anniversary at our college for the Longhouse, having been established for 25 years. So he and his sisters are making 100 string bags, Sally bags, and they're small necklaces that will be gifted that day. But that's just one thing that they are making. And if you know anything about Sally bags, these are the bags in our area where weavers took apart gunny sacks and then would use other plant material to make this basket around gunny sack. And so eventually yarn came into our reach, and so then it transferred to yarn. But corn husk is used, and other materials are used to make these beautiful baskets. Well, to begin, so to get acquainted with the techniques, you make these miniature ones, but you make enough of them so that they're gifted to others. And so that's one of the things that they're doing, but they're also making cattail mats, cattail bowls, cattail medallions, sweetgrass. And then of course, we've had the opportunity to gather our materials this year and fully process them. Sometimes if we're working and we're not sheltered at home, you don't have that time, you don't have that luxury to be so attentive to your material. Mm-hmm. And so now we're looking forward to a fall and winter of just being immersed and reclaiming some of these techniques that we've been, it's been shared with us, but you have to now spend the time to really become this expert where you then are teaching other tribal people how to do these techniques. So I think being sheltered at home, getting into that cultural schedule where you're greeting the morning, greeting that first sun. Well, see, even in the last 3 weeks of this intense smoke from the fires, you can't even see the sun. There was one 24-hour period that it was so overcast with smoke, you could not see daylight. Well, it turns the world upside down for squirrels, deer, birds, ducks. So it's this, if you do not have this schedule, see, I think the chaos enters your being, your soul, your mind, your emotions. Everything is out of sync, but keeping a schedule, a cultural schedule, I think is paving the way for good mental health, a solid cultural stability. We're also preparing for the first feast, the first food ceremony at our smokehouses. And that's usually during late September, early October. And so we've already prepared, and we won't be able to go. It'll just be the close relatives who can social distance, who maintain the smokehouses. There may be a few visitors, but not the 3 to 500 people that normally would go for the first food ceremony. Mm-hmm. It's our Thanksgiving in this area, but it's referred to as the first foods. So knowing that culturally, we need to thank the people for coming. So that's why these gifts. And see, I think that's a tribal identity and place where you maintain. It's like being famous for potato salad. So Kobe Heigl will be expected to be bringing his knowledge of Sally bags. Mm-hmm. So how many will you bring, Kobe, for this gifting of our people to thank them for having come? So I think that's what our kids are learning. We have this time during COVID to be really aware of what our knowledge is and our gift. So, and see, the gift isn't meant to be kept. Mm-hmm. It's a gift that you then give. Mm-hmm. So that's
great. I love that explanation for our listeners of the giveaway ceremony and what does that mean. And I like your, just to point out the integration of, you know, I guess nature in thinking about what's happening with the wildfires. You know, like here in where I'm at in Montana, we've had a lot of wildfires. And I find that a lot of the young deer are coming in and eating the, like the zucchini, my vegetable gardens, right? And I was out there, I'm like you, I get up early and I do a morning prayer. So I was facing east doing my prayers and I was thinking about these young deer. And I was thinking that they probably are scared from the fires, they're running, and that they need nourishment. And my garden is providing that for them.
Right.
And so it's like reciprocal, right? But see, yeah. We're still in tune. We're, you know, like I always think about that, you know, that the gift we can give you know, people across the world is to be part of, you know, the whole nature. Don't put human beings as hierarchy. Can you see yourself? Yeah, because I can see ourselves, like, you know, the Cheyenne running. We ran, you know, from the military, from the U.S. government, you know, and for days we had no food, no water. We were running for survival. And you think about who helped you during those times. And so I see myself like looking at the deer like that. They're running like us. I still have that memory.
Right.
And so they can eat my garden. I'm grateful right. that I have it to share with them.
Right.
Well, geez, Yvonne, we've covered a lot of issues, and I know we haven't even got to your, well, we've contacted some. I want to ask you the thing. When I first met you, I was so thrilled that you were, you know, getting the Master Weavers going again. That whole concept had kind of, you know, had passed on, and you were trying to figure out how am I going to get that back into the tribes so that there's this, you know, it's integrated. So can you share us a little bit about the Master Weavers?
Yes. So in my family, one of the first public ceremonies, so there can be family ceremonies. I could be with two other weavers and I literally could acknowledge the criteria that someone has met and proclaim that as you move forward now, claim that title, Master Weaver, for your tribe. So the public ceremonies, when my daughter was in eighth grade, she was brought out by the Skokomish smokehouse people and the tribe as a Master Weaver. And so there were several criteria that she had met, including pounding, and then weaving a cedar garment. And so the smokehouse father, who is also a weaver, help put the finishing touches that day as she came publicly and was brought in a circle through the four directions and the pillars, and then brought into the circle to be proclaimed as a master weaver. But it was also this recognition of her entering this adulthood stage where there would be adulthood things that she would now be expected to also accomplish and pay attention to. So we're moving her from childhood then into young womanhood. And so in terms of trying to capture for others what they could establish as criteria, so we always looked at it in terms of seven. So the seven teachers that have been instrumental in your coming to know how to identify the weaving plants, how to keep them healthy, how to be the protector of these plants and trees and bark and roots, but then how to gather, how to process, how to prepare. And then of all of these skills that you have been taught, what will you be masterful about? So you get to choose one. And that's one of the teachings of our people, is that you don't teach everybody the same thing, because then they won't need each other. So even though we have many people who are masterful and master teachers using cedar bark, many of them have a different technique that they have become masterful about. I have a sister who is very accomplished with multiple techniques, and she always writes things down in her recipe book. The plant, the season, who taught her. And see, that's the other criteria, is that as the person moves forward in their own work, they're always acknowledging their first teacher. Mm-hmm. And so, see, when you do that, you're acknowledging the ancestral teaching, because it goes way back to a point in time where we're not even knowledgeable about where this information came from. And I say that because I have a grandson who specializes in the X technique. And so in the different archaeological digs, we always thought that it only was a weave that occurred in northern tribes, say Swinomish and Tulalip North. Well, as the digs have occurred right here in our Puget Sound, Salish Sea area, we know that that technique was also rich here. Perhaps ancestrally, that's why it came relatively easy to him, and mm-hmm. he specialized with it, as did Hazel Pete. And to the dig, they have been treated and looked at in terms of how old this technique is. It's known to be 10,000 years old.
Wow.
So see, that's why I say you acknowledge your teachers, mm-hmm. because it acknowledges the ancestral knowledge all the way back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. And see, it would have been insects, birds, sometimes even the four-legged, who have offered to us their antlers for tools, their mm-hmm. bones for needles, their bones for awls. So, see, we're thankful to all of the life force around us in terms of when you become a master weaver. We value that the person carries their tribal name. And mm-hmm. so if they haven't done that, by the time they come out as a weaver, then they've gone through that ceremony mm-hmm. Before they come out. The reason that tribes will establish their own sense of who their master weavers are is because it's in their recorded history. For the Chehalis, things when you read on our page for the tribe is that the Chehalis are known for weaving, fishing, the exchanges of bartering and networking with the tribes in the area. Our seated area abuts at least five major tribes, some of them very different from what we do. So, see, it's that networking that the Chehalis are known for. Even within my family, the three oldest grandmothers would camp at the Hump Tulips and start to gather all of their basket materials that they would gather, dry, prepare, and then as they headed to the mouth of the Columbia River, crossing over 14 prairies, they would barter and trade all the way down. So it'd take them 2 years to get there. And then with being at the fort, then they would get other things, metal and breakable glass objects and probably stuffs. And then they would travel back up to the Hump Tulips. We imagine that they probably made three trips like that. Indian women on a covered a coach, a horse and buggy. Uh-huh. And so, you know, by the 20s, as automobiles started to come into the area, so see, and then farmers putting up fences on the prairie, there would be a point in time where you just could not have done that. So, see, for our family, even when we set up a table at a powwow, at a now we have conferences for basket making, and so we will have a table there. See, it's in your genes to be this person who barters, networks, trades, offers things for sale. See, that in itself is an art, to be able to do that, to accumulate and then distribute the wealth back to the family contributed to that table. I'm in awe of some of the grandmas older than myself, and I'm 72, who they are the economic life strand for people in their village who cannot leave home for one reason or another, but they give all of their things for sale to this one grandma. She loads her pickup up, and then she travels to these various events to sell. And see, that's what COVID has done to our artists, is that all of that is restricted. We don't have those gatherings now. And if that has occurred since February, as we move forward now, and they say another full year where we will have to socially distance and wear masks, that's an economic loss for the tribal people who have relied on that. Some of them, that's their single source of income. So others have tried to figure out ways. So you'll see on Facebook, weavers, but artists just in general, will offer something for sale, and then have found success. And so now it's starting to build into this industry. It seems to me that coming out as a master weaver has a reward that's connected back again to identity. And it's connected back again to knowing that because this is a gift and now you carry this label, master weaver, that gift then now gets disseminated where one of your obligations is to make sure more weavers are coming up and coming into their own in terms of knowing the plant life, knowing the animal life that contributes to your being a weaver. So
you know what strikes me is, Yvonne, like the system that you share of ancestors' knowledge and young people moving into that, becoming master weavers, disseminating their knowledge, it's such in conflict with the Western capitalistic system. And, you know, we live in the United States that is heavily individual, individual wealth, right? But we're still tribal wealth.
Yes. Now, see, here would be a good example. Had the legacy leaders been able to come to Lummi a year ago now, for the paddle to Lummi, what I've observed when we are set up at a sales table as a vendor. And so if you can imagine tribal people from Oregon, Northern California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Western Montana, mm-hmm. the Vancouver, Canada area, and Alaska. But that's not to also include the people who come from the Eastern Seaboard to bring their tribal wares and specialties to also be vendors. Well, when young people are working back at their camp, so the Skokomish Canoe family would be teaching how to make a cedar pouch or a cedar bracelet or a cedar headband. Well, what these kids will then do is to go up and barter, and we'll take them through their open and here's what you can try. So if they have their eye on a sweatshirt, they'll let that vendor know, I'm learning how to make these. How many could I make so that I can trade for this sweatshirt? And so, see, the vendor will look at it and say, oh, well, how many do you have? That's enough. And so then they'll trade. Mm-hmm. So, see, it spurs that 10-year-old to come back to say, I really want to get this down now. Now I'm ready. I can see the logic for why I need to know this. So it's within the bartering as opposed to economic competitive foundation of corporate America. It's within this bartering to affirm the traditional knowledge and the skill from young tribal people. Even as a vendor, I know I have to make so much to cover gas, food. Well, once I've made that, see, then I can work with a 10-year-old to say, oh, well, here's what I need if you're interested in this. Or if I say, who's your teacher? And they say, Toonie Moose, Yvonne Peterson. And so they'll say, well, you tell her you want to learn how to. So that, see, I get challenged too, where the kid comes back to say, well, they really want this. Do you have enough? So I think that's also the value of tribal people and being a vendor, but also being a tribal person who is just starting out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As an artist.
Mm-hmm. You know, one final question, given what we're going through with the fires and the pandemic, everything that's occurring, you know, are your people looking at how to deal with the climate change, particularly in like the plants, gathering of the plants that that you need to continue, like the master weavers, that whole culture?
The tribe, at least 6 weeks ago, interviewed elders. And so I participated. Well, see, if this was happening 6 weeks ago, that tells me that 6 months ago, the tribe, out of all of their things that they need to accomplish regarding the status of climate change mm-hmm. and the future for the Chehalis tribe. Then they went for a grant, and then they put the call out for who was going to do what. And so this group of young people that then interviewed elders then put together a question, a questionnaire. And so as it got sent to us, it said, are there other questions that we should be asking? And that's one of the things that I put in as a master weaver was, do I see an awareness? Do I have an awareness of the significant change of what's happening to our basket material? Another question was, or another one that I thought would be valuable is, during your lifetime, what have been the protocols that you know our people practiced so that the plants would return from one season? Mm-hmm. So what is it that we do? And see, that question wasn't on there. And then another one was, are there laws and policies, and what is your lived experience with, you know, these actual written down laws that are either within the tribe, within local, state, or federal laws that protect plants? Mm-hmm. Because it's a treaty right. Mm-hmm. So the treaty right in this area for the Stevens Treaties, it connects the picking of berries and plants mm-hmm. Is guaranteed within the treaty. So because we've had fishing rights literally go as far as the United States Supreme Court, I've always said within my lifetime, I see us as tribal people moving forward to protect our plants mm-hmm. or the way we eat them, use them for medicine and for our ceremonies, but then also for industry, for weaving. But see, there may be some other things that I'm not knowledgeable about mm-hmm. that we also need these plants protected for, that it will at some point go to court. And so in terms of an awareness, well, that was one of the first things that people who gather initially was all of those trees that were burned. Because, mm-hmm. you know, when you see it on the media, it always talks about the forest fires. Mm-hmm. Well, all of those trees that have provided the medicine, mm-hmm. the plant, the bark and the root for the different ways that we use it within ceremony. Mm-hmm. But see, the other way that we become knowledgeable about the role of the forest is that our stories tell us about the plant life that are the protectors for the other medicine that grows within this forest mm-hmm. environment. Mm-hmm. So it's not just trees that are in the forest. There are these smaller plants that tribal people have used. Mm-hmm. The medicine for what keep us well, and not just physically, but emotionally. That mind state presence that you need for prayer. Mm-hmm. And I mean the prayer that is so powerful that it can create and provide the way for us to see a way into the future. So even the gatherers were the first to say, all that nettle, mm-hmm. all that devil's club. See, those are the things that we have lost. And for those individual non-Indian owners who would not let us in mm-hmm. to gather, see, it's to their destruction. When the federal government has had hard, fast lines until tribal people were aggressive enough to say, those are held in also in protection for tribal people. So tribe by tribe has gained access to these federal forests. So if we have not gotten it, see, now it's lost.
Yeah.
And, you know, even when Trump talks about, well, all you need to do is clear out the forest growth, you know, down at the bottom of the trees, and that would protect them. Well, if you don't let the tribal people in there to do that, see, even he, as one of the agents that has protected, and not even to his knowledge, the federal forests without allowing tribal people free access in and about to gather. See, there's a reason for us to work in full circle with the environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, see, when you were offering, humans are not at the top mm-hmm. of the food chain. Mm-hmm. We're probably way at the bottom mm-hmm. in terms of acknowledging the role of the devastation that was lost in the forest fires. Mm-hmm. So all of that needs to come full circle, that recognition of how we're part of the circle, and that's all we are. We're part of the way to keep this plant, this world protected and viable for the future. Not just my children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, since I now have a great-granddaughter, but the generations I will not see. Mm-hmm. See, and if I have done my work well enough, my name will carry into that seventh generation. Mm-hmm. So I always think about when we have lost a name
mm-hmm.
and we haven't said the name, you know how they say the name, say the name. Well, yeah. Tribal people have begun, or maybe we've just started to recognize, we still need to carry the names forward, mm-hmm. say the name into the future mm-hmm. so that it lasts for seven generations, because their work was that important.
Yes, I hear you. I hear you, sister. You know, like I think about the work ahead for our young people, you know, I think that it's an exciting time for young people. I think the pandemic has, I'm hoping, shifted their thinking to come around to our way of thinking, you know, start thinking more like us instead of that Western world of greed and profit. So, like, for example, you know, the Custer Forest is next to my reservation. Just the name, Custer Forest.
Yes.
Why do we call it the Custer Forest? You know, that is our ancestral homeland, where our people are actually buried there. And a few years back, an elder was arrested crossing the private land, because all along the river is private land that's been, you know, homesteaded and held. So to get to the Custer Forest to gather his plants, he was a medicine man. He was arrested. A white rancher called in to the county police, and they came out. And he called me from the county jail, which is like, you know, an hour away. They took this old man. And he told me I was arrested for picking plants, trying to get to the plants. This is the time I got to get them, Gail. And I was like, this is such a, it's like so hard for me to believe that this old Cheyenne man, one of the oldest medicine and knowledgeable man, is arrested trying to get to our homeland.
Right.
And it's called the Custer Forest. And he said, I have to pick this plant now because it's going to go. And it's only a short season. And he said, right. I just pleaded. He said, I was begging this white rancher, just let me cross the land just for a little while. I won't touch anything. I just need to go gather some plants. Instead, he called the county police. So I tell that story because I think that those white ranchers and the greater government, the powers to be, need to understand that, like, we have gathering rights at the very least. You know, we also want hunting rights in the Custer Forest. This is our land. And then, like, my dad was, a couple of days ago, my son, he called me and he said, "Mom, I'm feeling better." He had COVID. He said, "I'm feeling better, and I'm going to go horseback riding today." And I said, "Oh, I'm so glad to hear that." I said, "Go up to your grandpa's," we always call this area, I said, "your grandpa's orchard." And it's way out in the mountains behind our place on the reservation, Northern Cheyenne. And there's these big sand rocks where all these mountain lions live, because sand rocks stay warm. But the warmth of these sand rocks has created this little valley where you get these huge wild plums. Oh. So my dad would always say, "We got to go pick plums." That's where we would always go. It's up this winding creek. So I told him, I said, "You know, I won't make it up there this year." I said, "Ride your horse up there." And I said, my dad used to always say that you kids get up there, and even if you don't have time to pick, well, ride through that area and eat the plums, because that's why they'll come back next year.
That's right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I told my son, I said, "I'm so glad you're feeling better from COVID now. You're going to go horseback riding. There's one place you need to go." And so he called me back and he was like, "Oh, Mom," he said, "those plums are giant up there. You're right." And he said, "I filled my pockets up." He said, "I just enjoyed, he ate all the way home." But, you know, our knowledge is like, it's like that, right? And I always think, you know, my hope is that we have that thinking. Now, the greater world needs to understand our way of thinking, because, you know, we're indigenous to this land. And I just hope that they're going to come along at some point, you know, before, you know, calling the police on this old man, right? Can you just listen to him and mm-hmm. be willing to let him cross your land? He won't bother nothing. When in reality, that's our land.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how are we ever going to get back, you know, some basic justice, right? Like, you look at the Black Lives Matter, like they're talking about, you know, reparations. Well, in our area, reparations would be very meaningful if we could just get access across the river into the Custer Forest to gather and hunt.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. To just be. Just be, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all important.
Thank you, Yvonne.